Thank you. It's my great privilege to introduce Tony Esselin. Tony's a person who hardly needs any introduction. He's a graduate of Princeton University, has a PhD from NC State, or no, I'm sorry. Sorry, Tony, wherever you are. UNC, the rivals. That was bad. That was a bad mistake. And he's taught at many colleges. He is incredibly prolific. He has written books. He's known for his translations of Tasso and Lucretius and Dante's Divine Comedy, and at least 15 other books that I could find, and that list is probably not complete. Ironies of Faith, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Western Civilization, The Beauty of the World, 10 Ways to Destroy the Imagination of Your Child, Reflections on the Christian Life, Defending Marriage, Reclaiming Catholic Social Teaching, Life Under Compulsion, 10 Ways to Destroy the Humanity of Your Child, Real Music, A Guide to Timeless Hymns in the Church, Out of the Ashes, Angels, Barbarians, and Nincompoops, Defending Boyhood, How Building Forts, Reading Stories, Playing Ball, and Praying to God Can Change the World, The Hundredfold, Songs for the Lord, Sex and the Unreal City, and No Apologies, Why Civilization Depends on the Strength of Men, which is due out next year. He's been cranking out about a book a year, along with many essays in Touchstone and First Things and Crisis, Modern Age, Claremont Review of Books. Tony is very, very prolific and a very productive person, a person who has been very much engaged in fighting the good fight. And Tony is perhaps the only poet that I know. I know people who write poems for a living, and Tony really doesn't, although he does have a book of poetry that's on the back table here. I just snarfed this one. I have to put it back when I'm done. But Tony just thinks like a poet. He sees the world in a way that is poetical. It's like he listens to the song of the cosmos and the universe, and it comes out in his prose. I don't know anyone else who can write the way that Tony does. It's just so beautiful. And you all probably know that because you've all read his works, or else you probably wouldn't be here to listen to him. But our conference today is called, what is it called there? No Neutral Ground. But there's a subtitle, too, and the subtitle says The Cost of Discipleship in a Secular Age. And Tony knows this. He's paid the price. He's fought the good fight, and he knows what this is like. And so perhaps a good way to introduce Tony is to take the paragraph from his introduction to his book of poems, where he ends it by saying, I'm a battered old soldier on bad knees who knows that the hill must be charged. And who knows of one or two ways that it might be done? He takes up the torn standard of the cross and hobbles up the first reaches of that height, crying out instructions that he himself has not the strength to fulfill, teaching more by audacity and exposure than by success, willing to look like a fool, to be shot down in the first volleys, but knowing that unless he or someone like him does this, the hill will remain always in the fist of the enemy. And so he goes. That's from Tony Esselin, and that is who he is. Tony, we look forward to your talk.
Thank you, Tom. I am assuming that everyone can hear me. Raise your hands if you can hear me. Yes, okay, all right, thank you. I think I was assigned this topic about lying because I've been in academia for so long. It gives you the qualifications. Most of what goes on in academia, as what goes on in journalism, is frankly a pack of lies. Anyway, I'd like to start off with the words from Jesus here. Why do you not know my speech? Jesus asked the Pharisees, who had already witnessed the wonders he had wrought. This is in the Gospel of John. Jesus has already fed the multitudes, right? So they've witnessed the wonders, but they haven't greeted those wonders with wonder of their own, or even with delight. Because you cannot hear my word, Jesus answers. That's why you do not know my speech. You are of your father, the devil, that is the accuser. He was a murderer from the beginning, and he stood not in the truth, because truth is not in him. When he speaketh a lie, he speaketh of his own, for he is a liar and the father thereof. Right? This is powerful stuff. And I've asked myself in preparing this paper, what those two have to do with one another, that is to be a murderer from the beginning and a liar, father of lies. I hope what I say will bring this out. Not a pleasant topic of discussion, but perhaps necessary. It seems to me there are two sorts of people who do not hear the words of Jesus. There are those who have never heard them. They include many in our midst who believe they have heard them vaguely, loosely, merely as rumors, often not very reliable rumors. Those people who think they know what Christianity is all about may be in a worse position to be evangelized than our strict pagans who've never heard the name of Jesus. But then there are those who have set themselves against those words, okay? It's not that they haven't heard them or they've heard them in a mangled way. They have heard them and they've set themselves against them. Now, I dare not judge the individual case, right? I don't know if you say, well, that person has heard the words of Jesus and has rejected them. That I can't say. I think it's a different matter if we're talking about a culture or the remains of a culture or a civilization. And then I think that's appropriate question to ask. Has this civilization consciously and deliberately rejected the words of Jesus? We must ask whether that people most miserable and making misery for others have given themselves over to the lie. Okay, and we must ask this of ourselves. I recall here the shrewd words of Whitaker Chambers at the beginning of the book Witness. You should all read that once every couple of years. He's describing for his children, who he hopes will someday read the book, what communism is. Chambers says, communism is not the dictatorship of the proletariat, not the collectivization of farms, not anything identifiably political or economic. Communism, he says, is the world's second oldest religion. It is summed up in the words of Satan. Chambers sums it up in those words. Satan, the murderer from the beginning, by which Jesus does not simply mean a long time ago. Satan is the anti-creator, the murderer, the destroyer, the accuser, who says to Eve, as Chambers quotes him, ye shall be as gods. That's the second oldest religion in the world. That's the heart of communism, says Chambers. Now, that's more than an alternative idea about the created order. The very notion of creation is at stake. Either we have a created order, which implies a creator, and which calls us to gratitude and to a harmonious acceptance of that order, even as man is God's viceroy and chief of the physical universe, either we have that, or we do not have a created order. And that means that we play at being gods ourselves. Nature is mere stuff to dominate. Practically speaking, this is C.S. Lewis in The Abolition of Man. If nature is mere stuff to dominate, right? If there is no order that we are called to respond to morally with gratitude and love, if nature is merely to dominate, what practically happens is that man dominates nature by using other men as tools. Or man subjects himself to be dominated because he bears no more inherent meaning than does a horse or a tree or the dirt beneath his feet. Thus is the lie put in the service of violence. That's what the lie is for. The lie is for violence. How do I deceive thee? Let me count the ways. For this talk today, I'll enumerate four ways. These are all manifest in John Milton's poem, Paradise Lost. I'm using Paradise Lost as a jumping off point. We could use Dante, we could use Shakespeare, all right? This is not peculiar to Milton and his vision. I'll enumerate them according to their objects, four objects of false witness. And in each case, I'll describe at least one way in which the West that has rejected Jesus utters such lies at the expense of human life, and often precisely to destroy human life. Before I get to those four, I want to stress that the line, "Ye shall be as gods," I think Chambers saw this. This is more than a bit of trickery. This is more than Satan getting Eve to eat of that apple, and he dangles something in front of her to trick her with, and she does, etc. The lie, "Ye shall be as gods," contains within itself all sin, all evil. It breaks all the commandments at once. "Ye shall be as gods." It is an act of idolatry, self-worship, an abasement of man in place of the sublime worship of God, right? You end up worshiping yourself. Takes the name of God in vain. Satan has reduced the sacred plural Elohim, that name that mysteriously suggests the plenitude of God, that Christians believe is an intimation of the Trinity. He's reduced it to any old plural, right? It's a reduction of God to a creature. Elohim knows that in the day you eat thereof, you shall be as Elohim, okay, as gods. It is directly opposed to the calm and joyful rest of the Sabbath. It says, "Do this right now, do this, and you shall have power to do much more." It is impiety against the Father. It is murderous. And in fact, murder is the first sin we are told of after Adam and Eve are expelled from the garden. We have, "Ye shall be as gods," then murder. The sin would gladly hail the death of God. It is lust for strange flesh. It's as if some created thing could delight us in the place of God, the God who made Adam and who gave Eve to him as his helpmeet. And sure enough, after they eat the apple, we see the sadness of bodily shame in the aftermath of this lust, right? The act of lust followed by disillusionment and shame. It is theft because the fruit of the tree is not theirs to eat. It is false witness against God, whom Satan portrays as petty, envious, not desirous of the best for the human couple, and not even God, as if God had to resort to a trick to keep Adam and Eve from doing something he does not want them to do. Of course, it is coveting with a vengeance. Satan doesn't simply want Eve to eat the fruit. He wants her to long to eat it. And in fact, she does. And the woman saw that the fruit was good to eat and fair to the eyes and delightful to behold. And sure enough, the rest of Genesis is a saga of the corruption of human desire, most clearly evident in the many ways we get procreation wrong. By the way, this and is an aside. I guess I can accept the traditional, now traditional, critical evaluation of Genesis as a being put together from three texts, the Yahwist, the Elohist, and the priestly. But boy, I have never seen a unified work such as Genesis is as result of a pastiche. It reads as one continued saga, always visiting the same motifs again and again and again. We get procreation wrong, we get the family wrong, the whole way through Genesis. Man, we may say, is corrupted in the seed. Man tells lies about reality, first form of the lie, first form that I'm discussing here today. The object here is the created order. Man sets himself against other created things. Now, Milton's Satan, Milton is very careful to portray creation as abundantly, lavishly good, okay? God is not stingy in Milton's Paradise Lost. Milton's Satan knows that the created world is ravishingly beautiful. He admits it when no one's around to hear him. Satan is the great politician, and that means, of course, for Milton, the great liar. Everything that he says when someone is near to hear him is either a lie or a half-truth designed to deceive, okay? Only when no one is around to hear him does he sometimes utter the truth, and then he immediately falls back into deceiving himself, okay? He knows that the created world is beautiful. This is what he says, O earth, with what delight I could have walked thee round if I could joy in aught. Sweet interchange of hill and valley, rivers, woods, and plains, now land, now sea, and shores with forests crowned, rocks, dens, and caves. But I in none of these find place, refuge. And the more I see pleasures about me, so much more I feel torment within me, as from the hateful siege of contraries. All good to me becomes bane, and in heaven much worse would be my state. And by the way, another aside, note the satanic attitude, right? That you perceive what is good, you can't help but note somehow that it is good, but you hate it because it's good. Those of you who are married and have lots of children may experience this kind of envious hatred of the good. So that's Satan. But when he insinuates himself into the body of the snake to tempt Eve, he expresses scorn for this same material world. He hates it. Okay. I was at first, he says to Eve, in the form of the snake, I was at first as other beasts that graze the trodden herb, of abject thoughts, and lo, as was my food, nor aught but food discerned or sex, and apprehending nothing high. He was that way, he says, until he ate of the fruit. In other words, it was a disgusting, contemptible thing to be that created being, that snake. If the fruit made a rational creature out of a snake, why, it can make an angel or a god out of man. Now notice how broadly aimed the scorn is. What should a snake think about if not food and sex? That's to think in a way proper to snakes and their lives. Satan implies here that it is contemptible to be a snake, but so then must it be contemptible to be only human when you can be so much more. Of course, the irony is that these only human beings, Adam and Eve, are made in the image and likeness of God. And by obedience, they may bring themselves into closer and closer union with God. But Satan here, right, think of the transhumanists among us, right? Satan here is saying, it's contemptible to be what I was. I'm much more now. You also can be so much more. Satan has betrayed disgust, but not when Eve is near, for his having to adopt the body of the snake in the first place. This here is a parody of the incarnation of Christ, and it is marked by a prissy contempt for fleshly reality. Oh, foul descent. He's about to use the snake as a tool, right, as a robot. This is not an incarnation. It's demonic possession of a created being. Oh, foul descent, that I who erst contended with gods to sit the highest am now constrained into a beast and mixed with bestial slime, this essence to incarnate and imbrute, that to the height of deity aspired. But you know, he says, if you're going to be ambitious, you got to stoop down low, right? He who exalts himself should be humbled, says Jesus. We should think of that not as a prediction, but as a law of being. When in scorn for your place in the created order, you attempt to overleap what you are. You attempt to be transhuman by your own power. You fall in the act. Not later as a consequence, but in the very doing. Man as a pretended god is a beast, or perhaps lower than a beast. Adam and Eve are the original technocrats. They believe if they use the fruit of the tree as a tool, they will be as gods. That apple's flesh must contain just the right nutrients for deity. So do we become the tools of our tools. You may ask whether this denial of the created order is evident in our time. After all, we love nature. We We stand on bridges in state parks. We take pictures of rivers below. We don't pollute the world, I grant us, that we don't pollute the world with the same kinds of filth used when I was a boy. We pollute with different kinds of filth. When I was a boy, the sight of coal flakes piled up hundreds of feet high would greet me every time I went out my back door, okay, in Pennsylvania. Consider in our time, though, the deep hatred of the physical meaning of sex, that is the child-making act. And every time you get a dirty look from somebody because you have more than the allowable number of children, you're in the presence of someone who's got a real deep problem with the physical order. The pill is our apple. Take it. Submit to the pharmacy and its wizardry, and you can be as gods. Forget that what you're doing makes babies. Forget the babies. What is developing in the woman's womb? And think of the scorn and the downright rejection of scientific fact, the rejection of any engagement with the beauty of what's developing in the womb, right? That we get when we hear that it is, well, this is analogous to Satan's bestial slime that disgusts him. Well, when we think of the child we do not want, it is bestial slime. It is a clump of cells, a wart, or a parasite. Now, objectively speaking, biologically speaking, it is not an indiscriminate clump. It is not a wart. It is not a parasite. It is breathtakingly beautiful and human. But we tell the lie and heave the child out of the way. And in fact, a deep hatred of male and female nature characterizes many of our diseases. Think of the now celebrated mutilation of healthy bodies, right? Celebrated, this amputation, mutilation, or think, to bring more death into the picture, think of women in combat at no profit to themselves or to the men beside them or to their country. I mean, I'm not judging their intentions. I'm judging facts, right? Facts which we deny. Almost everything that we have to say about the sexes in our country is, in the West generally, is either a deliberate and self-conscious lie or is complete madness. Then there are lies that are aimed against others. And we're moving up the scale here in falsehood. In Paradise Lost, Satan must tell himself and the other devils lies about the unfallen angels, because otherwise the senselessness of their revolt and their loss would overwhelm them, and it would jeopardize Satan's preeminence over his followers. I said, Satan is the consummate politician, right? I mean, he knows that he is responsible for this devastation, but he can't ever admit to having made a single misjudgment, let alone committing a colossal sin in front of the other devils. He must play the part of the great, courageous, noble leader, okay? He must be a politician, all right? So when he's been caught trying to disturb the peace of Adam and Eve, he's in one scene in Paradise Lost, he's in the form of a toad, whispering into Eve's ear as she sleeps, trying to give her bad dreams, dreams of eating the apple, in fact. But he's caught. Satan has to put on a bold front before the angel Gabriel. Gabriel has been on the lookout for him, Gabriel and his troops. Satan says he's there to scout out a better place than hell for his comrades, right? I'm here perhaps to look things over, to settle here on earth, he says, or in midair, though for possession put to try once more what thou and thy gay legions dare against, whose easier business were to serve their Lord high up in heaven with songs to hymn his throne and practiced distances to cringe, not fight, okay? They're all cowards and hypocrites up there. They're not brave like us. They cringe. We decide not to cringe, right? You all have heard this sort of thing, okay? People who know that their lives are truncated unhappy, you're missing something, they're missing God. They see you going to church, praising God, and they say, you're doing it out of fear, you're doing it because you're cringing, you're not brave, right? This is a flat lie. Satan knows it. He's accused Gabriel and all the faithful angels, implying that they're good only for singing and dancing. And note well, not worshiping genuinely, but cringing. To this original hypocrite, everyone else must be a hypocrite too. A hypocrite or a coward or both at once. Here's another insult that Satan flings. This one is at the angel Abdiel. Abdiel is the lone angel among Satan's cohorts who has rejected Satan's lies. This is still in heaven before they're cast out of heaven and turned back courageously to God while all the others with Satan were hissing and jeering at him. Okay. He and Abdiel, by the way, should be, you should read Paradise Lost and take Abdiel as your inspiration. The secular world will be full of people jeering and hissing at you, and you might feel yourself quite alone in the world. Take Abdiel as your example. Well, Satan and Abdiel face each other as the war in heaven is about to begin. The insult touches Abdiel and everyone who remains faithful to God. This is Satan now. At first, I thought that liberty and heaven to heavenly souls had been all one. But now I see that most, through sloth, had rather serve ministering spirits trained up in feast and song. Such hast thou armed the minstrelsy of heaven, servility with freedom to contend, as both their deeds compared this day shall prove. Well, of course, their deeds this day prove far otherwise. The angels in revolt get the worst of it by far. That's not my point here. Notice that when you give yourself up to sin and it begins to do its hellish work within you, you must either repent or you must tell a lie about the sin. At first, that lie may persuade you. Think of the heady days of the sexual revolution. People were encouraged to disrobe themselves of decency and faithfulness and the fruitfulness of the body, then all would be sweetness and light. But the sweetness and light did not ensue. Misery did. So then, now we must lie about those who keep the faith. Our media think they rejoice far more when one member of a Christian church falls into grave sin, a pastor falls into grave sin, a Catholic bishop is caught with child pornography in an airport. This is the best day of the year for so many millions, okay? They are not happy, but they long to tell lies about those who remain faithful. Anyway, they rejoice far more, our media do, when one member of the Christian church falls into grave sin than for the 99 miserable people among them who have long yielded to the sin and gotten no great good from it. No television show will praise anyone who leaves the world to join with the Amish, let us say, or anyone who leaves a life of sad hedonism to be married and to have children after the ordinary way of nature. That's not going to be celebrated. That would be like the devils in hell celebrating angels that have remained faithful, or the devils in hell celebrating when someone says, I shall arise now and go unto my father and say, Father, I've sinned before thee and before heaven. The devils are not going to rejoice about that. The audience wants to see spiritual death, misery with a lot of skin. That's what sells. Other than people of faith, whom do we lie about the most right now? Our forefathers, we murdered them. It's very strange that we're eager to pull down statues. Healthy cultures don't do that sort of thing, right? Their people honor their forefathers. They didn't pretend that the forefathers were perfect. The Romans didn't pretend that the great Roman leaders in the time of the Republic were perfect. It was enough that they were their forefathers and they did great things for their city. If you want to spread gloom over the face of a feminist, prove that the married men of past generations in the United States, and almost everyone above the age of 25 was married, prove that they generally treated their wives with honor and tenderness, and that men despised other men who raised hand in anger against a woman. They would call them cowards, right? Show that. Denounce the slander. Why is she not happy to learn that Grandpa was less of a cad than she had thought? Why does it spread gloom upon her to find out that perhaps things were not horrible? Why do we want to believe the worst about men like Robert E. Lee or Stonewall Jackson? Every man is to be judged by his worst sins in the worst light. We might as well all get in line to the regions below because that's where everyone is going. But we must lie about others because even we don't believe the flattering lies we tell about ourselves. But then that's my third category, right? We do tell lies about ourselves. Satan knows that he has led his host to misery. He knows that he cannot overcome God. He also knows that his plan to ruin the lives of the newly created human couple will bring no benefit to him or to his comrades. In fact, he knows quite the opposite, that it will make things worse for him. Okay? Doesn't matter. He can't say so. Politics forces his hand. He must lie. So here he bids farewell to those mighty angels before he leaves hell to seek more misery upon earth. He says, you guys stay here, comb through hell to find something to alleviate the pain here. Quote, while I abroad through all the coasts of dark destruction seek deliverance for us all. Satan portrays himself as a patron of liberty. But what really marks him is a pride that cannot bear even an equal, let alone a superior, in the Son of God. So he, Milton says, aspiring to set himself in glory above his peers, shows himself on the first day of the war in heaven, not as a Republican leader, not as first among equals, but as a God, a pretended God who would unseat God. High in the midst, exalted as a God, the apostate in his sun-bright chariot sat, idol of majesty divine, enclosed with flaming cherubim and golden shields. It's a lie about himself. He's got to tell it. So too does he appear at the council in hell later on. The devils are assembled to determine what they should do now. Beneath the facade of a Republican debate, the foregone conclusion has been set in place, right? But this is our first vision of Satan in the council chamber, high on a throne of royal state, which far outshone the wealth of Ormuz and of Ind, or where the gorgeous East with richest hand showers on her kings, barbaric pearl and gold. Satan exalted sat, by merit raised to that bad eminence, and from despair thus high uplifted beyond hope aspires beyond thus high, insatiate to pursue vain war with heaven. Such lies soak the earth in blood. Call the words of Jesus. His disciples are quarreling about who among them was the greatest. Jesus says, the kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and they that have power over them are called benefactors. But it is not to be so among you, right? So all politicians do this, right? You should vote for me because I'm your benefactor. Call this the 11th plague of Egypt, the plague of the benefactors. Lenin, Stalin, Hitler, Mao, Che Guevara, Fidel Castro, and innumerable other bringers of salvation, great and small. And everyone among us who plays the part of a hanger-on, a tool, a cheerleader, a patsy, all who bask in the glare of worldly greatness, who gladly accept a lie about the great in order to lie about themselves. I'm with him, and he's the savior. There's no Alexander without the many millions who wish to share in the booty as micro-Alexanders. Well, Milton will have none of this, right? The archangel Michael says to Adam, as the late in Paradise Lost, that fall has occurred. They're going to be expelled from the garden. He shows Adam what's going to happen to the human race in years to come, right? Says Michael, to overcome in battle and subdue nations and bring home spoils with infinite manslaughter shall be held the highest pitch of human glory, and for glory done of triumph to be styled great conquerors, patrons of mankind, gods and sons of gods. Destroyers, rightly are called, and plagues of men. Perhaps we're too effeminate now, despite the absurd and murderous push to make warriors out of women, to pride ourselves on military conquest. But in our time, war slays his thousands, and lust slays his 10,000s. Maybe I should say her 10,000s or zer 10,000s or whatever reality denying or self-aggrandizing and grammar vitiating pronoun you choose. Everyone can have his 15 minutes of being an Alexander in lust, destroying people's lives all around without requiring Alexander's courage or skill on the battlefield. And then there are lies about God, my fourth and final category here. All lies have God as the ultimate object. Some lies, however, are direct assaults. Our great forbidder, Eve calls God, safe with all his spies about him. Our great forbidder, who has given them the whole created world to enjoy and to embellish by their labor, who requires of them no action, but merely to refrain from an action, the easiest action in the world to refrain from, because they have all the world. They have plenty to eat. They have everything they need. They merely must keep their hands off the fruit of one tree. The spies. Who are these spies? Ministering angels, whom Satan himself has pretended to despise, as if it were beneath angelic dignity to serve man. But why stop at slandering God when you can deny him outright? That we were formed then, sayest thou? Satan sneers at Abdiel. Abdiel says, we were made by God. It said, oh, really? We were made by God? Seeming to elevate his status, Satan actually demotes it. If the angels have not been created by God, then they must be the results of natural and fatalistic development. They must, well, have evolved, okay? They rose naturally and inevitably, we can say, from celestial stew. This is what Satan says. Who saw when this creation was? Rememberest thou thy making while the maker gave thee being? We know no time when we were not as now. Know none before us, self-begot, self-raised by our own quickening power. When fatal course had circled his full orb, the birth mature of this our native heaven, ethereal sons, right? Why would man not want the tremendous honor of being a son of God? Because then other men would also be sons. And then it's hard to justify the miserable things you want to do to them. The child in the womb is made in God's image, no less than Alexander was, no less than Simone de Beauvoir or Margaret Sanger were. A good son obeys the father and loves and respects his brothers. But when you want to rub your brothers into the dirt, or you want to rub yourself into the dirt, as did the son in Jesus's parable, you must break with the father. The son in Jesus's parable has essentially wished that his father were dead. You must, in your heart, murder the father. And here we see the inmost evil of all attempts to sell change as the one political and social thing to be desired. It is aimless and restless, yes, thus easy to condemn. But we should remember that the liar wants to murder, not to give life. Change, irritable and sickly change in our time is a watchword for the denial of one's own duty to God, the denial of the humanity of every inconvenient human person, the denial of the created order as something beautiful that claims our gratitude and honor. Happiness cannot be the aim, can't be. Not when the mavens of change themselves evince none of it, but instead fill every public space with vulgarity, hatred, obscenity, ugliness, slander, suspicion, treachery, and ingratitude. Misery is the aim, a tower of misery, with men as the bricks. The towers the world builds no longer have even a superficial beauty to commend them. And here, as I close my talk, here's an opportunity for us. Peace, says St. Augustine, is the tranquility of order. And all human order that is worthy of honor is founded upon truth, and it aspires to truth. Liars may have glare and flash, but no beauty. The lie is a garish tattoo, a defacement. We must affirm the truth not in mere defiance of the liar, but as lovers of the truth, as people moved by its beauty to produce works of beauty and of any genuine freedom that man in this pilgrimage can know. In this aspiration devoted to our good and the good of our enemies, let us in peace and confidence give ourselves wholly up to him who is the way, the truth, and life. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. Every time Tony speaks at one of our conferences, I'm probably not alone, and I spend the next month or two reading poetry, and I think rereading Paradise Lost just went to the top of my list. I'm sure we have some people that have some questions for Tony, so if you can, as per usual, line up at the microphones, and Tony will answer you. I know some people have some questions.
I'll be offended if I don't get a question here.
Tony, what, this is only... Go right ahead.
I'm not going to ask a question, except I wish you were here. But somebody very close to Tony has asked me to offer a little commercial for what is perhaps his greatest book, which is the Hundredfold Songs for the Lord. And if you're like me, you know, I'm not a reader of poetry. It never got into my system. But Tony has kind of changed my mind on that. So he reads the poetry. He brings it alive for us. But the Hundredfold Songs for the Lord, a continuous poem, is just an amazing thing. And if you're like me, I've started very slowly because I read maybe a little part of the poem every night before I go to bed. But then as I do it further and further, I kind of develop the muscle and I'm able to read it more and more and to appreciate it. So, you know, maybe before you go into Milton, you might just want to start with Tony's. I know he's working on something else, but might as well start with Tony's own Hundredfold. So thanks, Tony.
Thanks, Peter. I wonder who that was who made that recommendation to you. I think she's a few feet away from me here. It's not good for the man to be alone. He needs a press agent.
This is more general and the subject of Satan. Perhaps you can shed some light on this. Two things. One is I recently read that Satanism is the worship of Satan because Satanists believe that Satan saved them from a jealous and overruling God. And my second thing is I read a book on exorcisms by a Catholic priest, and he mentioned several times that the demons would be screaming from inside the possessed body. Don't make us leave. We like it here. We don't like it in hell. If you can comment on that and the question about Satanism.
The thing about Satanism is just the old, it's the old lie, right? God doesn't want you to be free, okay? A odd thing about it is that the great pagan philosophers themselves instruct us here. If you are talking about liberty and you are not talking about virtue, and virtue is difficult to acquire, right? It demands discipline. It demands plenty of self-denial. Then you're not really talking about liberty. You're talking about license, and license enslaves, right? We don't even need the Christian revelation to come to that conclusion. So, you know, the Satanists say, I'm free. It's just a lie to cover their enslavement to sin. He who sins is a slave to sin. Jesus says this, but very much the same kind of thing can be found in the great Greek and Roman philosopher, right? Of course, nobody reads anything anymore, so people can you know, easily be fooled by this. If you just come on over here, you get to do whatever you please. It doesn't bring happiness, and it's almost an immediate self-enslavement. As for what the demons within a human person would be saying, I think that we have always to remember that they are liars. Okay. Even to say we like it here better than we like it in hell might be a lie.
I also read in the Exorcist book that demons like to mess with modern technology.
They can't be trusted in anything.
So, oh, I hope we don't. Paul, how's it? Anything we can do?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you now. Go ahead. Wait, but before you ask your question, we did have a couple people on the live streaming said they can't hear the people asking questions. So if you can just speak close to the microphone.
Spoke of the contempt of the flesh and the contempt of incarnation as being one aspect of this defiance, this ye shall be as gods, and you alluded to transhumanism just very briefly, and I wondered if you wanted to say a little bit more about our current moment and the role of embodiment and the flesh in our moment where human bodies are understood primarily as vectors for pathogens, and we have kind of a truly, and we have a notion of escaping that through technology and other means of avoiding the contaminations of the flesh, that the flesh has become our enemy in some way. I wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's a big subject there. I think you're quite right, and there are many directions we can go here. There's a strange kind of combination of vitalism and suicide at once, as if simultaneously the only thing that was really important in human life was longevity, that is to lengthen it out as much as possible. And yet at the same time, the people who seem to believe this want to escape from the pains of the body, or perhaps even the pains of the psyche, whenever they please, with assistance to make it comfortable, commandeering assistance in putting their lives at an end. That's a very strange combination, but perhaps it's worthy of some examination. That is, what do those two things that appear to be contradictory have deeply in common? And I would suggest they have in common this disgust with mere bodily reality.
So I have a question that relates to Milton and Dante, and as I understand it, you're the man to ask. So it has been a common experience for myself and my peers that reading Milton and then going through the Divine Comedy, characters such as Satan and the characters in the Inferno, and the Inferno itself as a book, are certainly the most accessible, typically the most memorable. And when we then turn our eyes to something, to the Paradiso, or in Paradise Lost, when we encounter the character of Christ, it's not as interesting to us from a literary perspective. And the characters don't seem as rich or vibrant. Do you think that that is a problem with us as readers? Or is there also something that's just from the author's perspective? Is it especially difficult for Milton and for Dante, as brilliant men, but as sinners nonetheless, to express the beatific vision and the beauty of heaven?
Dante himself says over and over, I do not have the language for this, right? From the very start, he is begging for the assistance of the Holy Spirit, because he knows that human words, mere human words, cannot convey this blessedness. And of course, he himself, still in the flesh, not seeing the beatific vision himself, can, I mean, he's completely dependent upon, practically speaking, he's dependent upon scripture and Christian art before him. He's dependent upon the grace of God and whatever inspirations the Holy Spirit may give him. Now, I don't agree with you about the cogency of characters in Inferno as compared with those characters that we meet in Purgatory. I think that Virgil and Statius in Purgatory, that is Virgil as Virgil in Purgatory, Statius in Purgatory, and several other characters in Purgatory, are as compelling as any character in Inferno, and I'd say in some ways, and in some cases, more compelling. But the interesting question here is that that meets us as readers or as artists is that we are not innocent, and therefore we have a great deal of trouble trying to portray innocence. The characters that we are most like in Paradise Lost before Adam and Eve fall are in fact the devils, right? We are not like the unfallen angels. We are not like God or the Son of God. We are not like the innocent Adam and Eve. And Milton understands that and is constantly, I think, deliberately tripping up his readers who will be quick to attribute to Adam and Eve evil motives even before they have eaten of the tree. But this is just projection on our part. You know, we're most like the devils. And Milton is deliberately making those devils like us, like characters from epic poetry, okay? And what we're to draw from that is not that the devils are epic and admirable, noble, brave, and so forth, but that there is something satanic in the heroic tradition itself, something satanic about man's worship of conquerors, right? Plagues, rightly are called, right? As Michael says, destroyers, rightly called, and plagues of men. Something wrong with us. We find that conversation in hell, what do we do now? Moloch, Belial, and then Mammon speak, then Beelzebub gets up, and we find it really compelling because that's what our politics is like. And Milton knows this. He's showing us up. Perhaps we'll know about how to portray truly beautiful and innocent characters when we become ourselves truly beautiful and innocent, but we're not there yet. Even Charles Dickens had trouble with that one, but I think there are authors who can show really good and noble characters as far more interesting than you find Satan in Paradise Lost, for instance. And Dickens occasionally does succeed at that. Shakespeare succeeds quite frequently with that, I think. And Dante in Purgatory succeeds. Paradise is a different thing. And by the way, you did mention something about Christ. Milton, I think, is very careful not to reduce Christ to a character. We almost don't want that, right? It's a character in a poem who does characteristic things, who has a personality. That would be, I think, theologically dubious. Milton to try. There would be something a bit odd about that, right? That's why much Christian art that depicts Jesus falls flat on its face.
One more question.
Hey, Tony, I appreciate your talk, and I'm thinking about, this is Dan Mattson, I wish you were here, how are you doing? I just want to, it was a very appropriate introduction that you have been a soldier, and you're battered, and you've taken some hits for the team, and a lot of us, I think, here are facing similar things. And I guess the question I have for you, as someone who's been there and gone down that road, what sustained you? What were temptations to despair? What was it that helped you get through the assault that went against you? Because I think we're all going to face that eventually. And you're a brave soul to have gone through it, but I think we could benefit from your wisdom.
Well, in my case, I mean, other than that, I have my family supporting me, and I had so much support from people like you. There was a kind of basic awareness that the people who were attacking me were, frankly, stupid. They didn't know things. I wouldn't want to be them under any circumstances. I mean, who would want to be inhabiting their flesh? Who would want their minds and their souls? In my case, they were more, I think, stupid than malevolent, though there was some malevolence. In your case, I think there's going to be a great deal more malevolence than stupidity. And that says a lot, because I think that stupidity level is about the same. So, but would you want to be one of those? I mean, perhaps the best response to this is not resentment or anger, but pity. I am not good at pitying people. I don't want to pity people, because it seems that you despise people whom you pity. You pray for them, and that's different. But maybe they ought to be objects of your pity. I mean, what a pathetic thing to be. You must be, if you are the person, Dan, who has attacked you. What a miserable, petty, little, cowardly, vile thing that must be. So we want to be that in any case, right? I mean, the enemies who are going after you, try to remember, these are not happy people. These are not intelligent, well-educated, flat-footed realists even, right? I mean, they're all devoted to some great measure of madness and unreality. Where's all the joy over there? Where's the mirth? I don't see any. Sure see a lot of anger and recrimination and ingratitude and so on. I mean, where's the great feast? Of course, our churches should be providing feasts, and often they provide instead cover for the enemies. And we've got a lot of people who are stupid and malevolent within the churches. But, you know, I mean, if the choice is between being sane and being one of those people, I don't want to be in their skin. What a lousy thing that would be. That helped. I mean, just to know that. These people were not just incorrect, but they're amputees, and they don't even know it. I wouldn't want to be that, right? That helped me anyway.
All right. Thank you very much, Tony.
God bless you all.